Between the Keys is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Funding for this program is provided in part by listener members like you. This is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and welcome to Between the Keys. My guest today is Ben Lawdy, who is a pianist and a teacher and a polymath and does everything in the world of the piano. He's a graduate of Rice University and the Juilliard School. He's appeared all over the United States in concerto and recital performances. He's taught at Bard College, and he's no stranger to the Classical Network because he collaborated with David Dubal on a special three-part tribute to Glenn Gould on The Piano Matters. Since 2019, Ben Lawdy has been the head of piano at Tonebase, one of the world's leading and most innovative online educational music resources. And it is Tonebase that brings Ben Lawdy back to the Classical Network and, for the first time, to Between the Keys. Welcome.
Jed, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
What do you offer at Tonebase? I know that there are hundreds of master classes, there are interviews with pianists, there are examples of great pianists in performance.
Well, I thought it might be better to show rather than tell. So why don't we begin with a Tonebase lesson, a repertoire lesson, taught by the eminent Claire Huangsi,
who is a former Between the Keys guest and a great friend of mine.
And she is one of the rare virtuosi who can play with such dexterity and flexibility and nuance, but also be able to talk about what she's doing, which is not something every pianist knows how to do. This is Claire teaching a Rachmaninoff prelude. She's playing probably the hardest prelude, which is the B-flat major, and breaking it down in the most accessible way.
It basically is the perfect epitome of Rachmaninoff. It has everything. It has these beautiful, grand gestures, and it sounds orchestral. Just from the piano textures, it encompasses the entire keyboard. And yet in the middle section, he has beautiful melodies that we know and love him for. And it's a mini piano concerto in the space of 3 or 4 minutes. It's definitely one of those pieces that after you learn it, you can really give yourself a big pat on the back and say that was quite an achievement. For me, the left hand posed the biggest challenge for sure in the first section of this prelude. And I overcame this with many weeks, actually, of very slow, kind of dotted practicing and just slow in general. Found my wrist moving a lot. So for the left hand, there's many moments where it's... And in order to have that rhythm being really clear, you have to really master it at a slow tempo and make it as expressive as you can in a musical way. Because, of course, this is quite a percussive. It's still majestically singing, I find.
Thank you.
just heard Claire Wanzi playing the Rachmaninoff Prelude in B flat major, opus 23, number 2. And before that, we heard Claire Wanzi teaching the prelude, and that comes from her tone bass lesson. The next artist is a friend of yours, Andrew Tyson.
Andrew and I went to Juilliard together, and I've always been in awe of his talent. Ever since the first performance of his I heard live, which was actually a chamber piece, the Rachmaninoff Cello Sonata. It wasn't just technically great, you expect that from a Juilliard master student like he was, but he was bringing out so many relationships in the music and inner voices and colors, and I have to say, I was jealous, but then I met him, and he's such a mensch, and we became fast friends, and we've really dorked out over the years listening to old great pianists, and I think he really has styled himself very much after the tradition of Courtauld and Rosenthal and Friedman and the rest of them. What you hear in his playing is a kind of blast from the past, but also something fresh and new. Although sometimes it might be too eccentric for yours or my taste, he always means it. It's not showmanship. He is well aware of his reasons behind his expressive devices. Again, not every pianist knows why they choose the rubato they choose. Andrew has sources of inspiration, whether it's imagery or the decisions he makes, the interpretations that he builds. And it's that intelligence, I think, combined with his fearlessness as a pianist that make him stand out for me among the younger generation.
So why don't we hear some of Andrew's lesson on the third movement from the Schubert Sonata in A major, Deutsch number 664, and then we will segue into Andrew playing the finale of the sonata.
When I initially interpreted this piece, in the interest of sort of creating a kind of playful character, I purposely fooled around a little bit with the rhythm of this knocking figure. I did something like this. While that might be charming once or twice, if one does that every time, it becomes a little bit mannered. And I ended up deciding that it wasn't a good idea also because I do want to emphasize the connection with the other two movements. I only say this just to sort of illustrate that, you know, interpretation is always a process and that it's always in flux. You don't ever want to be sort of completely set in your ways when you're interpreting a piece. Even over the course of, teaching in this video, no doubt I will discover new things about the music as well. There's sort of infinite riches to be discovered. Thank you.
We have just been spending time with Andrew Tyson speaking about and playing music of Schubert, the finale of the A major sonata, Deutsch number 664, known as the little A major, as opposed to the big A major. And I am here with Ben Loudy, who is the head of piano at Tonebase. Thank you for being here on Between the Keys. What do we have next?
In many ways, this is one of the most significant pieces of content that Tonebase has on its platform. I had the rare privilege to work with the late Leon Fleischer. I think like many pianists, I grew up with Fleischer's recordings of concertos with George Zell, particularly the Beethoven concertos and the Brahms concertos. I've always been in awe of his musicianship. He is stubborn, and I mean that in a complimentary way. He wouldn't have been the musician that he was without a really uncompromising sense of rhythm, of interpretation, of culture, of style.
Well, before we went on the air, you were saying that Leon Fleischer has this tenacity almost like no one. And, you know, when you look at the trajectory of his career, that he had his hand injury and he just spent almost the rest of the career determined that he was going to play with two hands again. And he finally did. But his path back to it led him to teaching, it led him to conducting. You actually played for Leon Fleischer, didn't you?
I did, although I have to admit, I wasn't just setting myself up to play for the man. I was trying to get some of his students to, but they weren't able to make it, so I had to fill in. Luckily, I had some Beethoven in my fingers, and I was able to play for him. This was actually in the year of his passing. In January 2020, we were very lucky to work with him in his home for 2 full days. We recorded 6 masterclasses, 2 lengthy interviews, one of which we just released, which is all about his experiences with his teacher, Arthur Schnabel. And I think that's part of what's so significant about his presence on this platform. He represents the continuation of a kind of oral tradition, what I like to think of as the passing down from mentor to student, of the kind of wisdom, that intangible wisdom of piano playing that you can't just write down in a book, that requires this kind of apprenticeship. And Leon Fleischer was lucky enough to be the apprentice of sorts of Schnabel, but also conductors such as George Zell, of course, but also Otto Klemperer.
Yes, in fact, he played the Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 4, I believe, for the first time with Otto Klemperer, not necessarily George Zell. And there is a recording of that performance with the, I don't know which orchestra. Oh, I think it's the Köln Radio Orchestra in Germany with Otto Klemperer. I think it's from 1957.
The following season, I did get a phone call. Klemperer was looking for a soloist. This would be a perfect time. Can you hop on a plane on such and such date and come over and rehearse? I said, of course. He said, Klemperer has only one condition, 2 conditions. He wanted to do G major Beethoven, 4th Beethoven, and I had to agree to having 4 rehearsals. And I was just overjoyed. Imagine to get to rehearse that 4 times with Klemperer and then play it. He was so tall that he didn't use a podium. He stood on the same level as the strings, as the fiddles, when he conducted. And we came to first rehearsal, and he ignored me totally. He worked only with the orchestra, assiduously. At the end of the cadenza, in the first movement, the big cadenza. Whatever tempo you arrive at, when you come back after the cadenza and you come to that opening material, da 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 da, you're back in that opening tempo, the first 5 bars, a little bit on the slow side. And Klemperer was insistent that you not get back to the main tempo of the movement, that you stay at this slower tempo. Keep it absolutely rigorously down. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. And it grows. Da, 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 dee, da. Da, 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 dee, ga, 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 wham, wham. And it becomes absolutely gigantic, mammoth, really filling the heavens.
Just heard the coda of the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in G major with pianist Leon Fleischer, Otto Klemperer conducting the Köln Radio Symphony Orchestra. After Leon Fleischer had to curtail his two-handed playing in the mid-60s, he started looking for other outlets for making music, including playing music for piano left hand, and he also took up conducting. He played a lot of contemporary music, but he also conducted a lot of the pieces that he had played, that he had made famous. And in fact, there is a recording of him conducting the Beethoven Emperor Concerto with Leonard Schur at the piano, and Leonard Schur was a pupil of Arthur Schnabel. And in fact, I think we were talking about how our mutual friend Emmanuel Axe had played the Emperor Concerto with Leon Fleischer at the podium.
That's right. And Tone Bass was lucky enough to work with Manny, as he allows us all to call him, because he's the friendliest pianist in the world.
And he's a former Between the Keys guest.
And I got to meet Manny in his beautiful home in the Berkshires in May, where he spent most of COVID learning new Chopin pieces.
One thing that's very typical about Manny Axe, which is very disarming and charming, but it's also kind of frustrating, is that he doesn't always like to talk about himself. He would much rather talk about all the great pianists from the past whom he admired or who he worked with, or he loves to talk about all the young pianists who he's mentoring and teaching. He told me that he was at Horowitz's historic 1965 comeback at Carnegie Hall. Manny talked to you about the G minor ballade of Chopin, which was a big Horowitz specialty.
Well, you'll have to sign up for Tone Bass to watch the full thing, but I have to share with you a little clip, because 15-year-old Manny Axe spent the night on the street outside of Carnegie Hall for an entire weekend with 100 other people waiting to get into this historic return concert of Vladimir Horowitz. He had great seats, and he had a wonderful view of Horowitz's very famous performance of the G minor ballade. And that performance made a particularly strong impression on Manny. And here he is demonstrating some of Horowitz's nuances in the first theme of that G minor ballade, including, again, some of magic's biggest secrets revealed. He's showing us something of what's behind Horowitz's magic in his touch, in his sense of timing, in his subtlety, something that you might not always think about listening to these great records. And again, something that Tone Bass can offer insights into.
For me, always the miracle of his playing, well, there's so many sides to it, but the fact that every line has a shape, you know, so the bass is never subservient to the melody. The melody's always alive. He always talked about singers, you know, how important it is to listen to singers. And
as did Chopin.
And you hear it so much because there's the line always has life. It bends up and down. Mm. You know, it's never flat. It's never... You never hear six notes in a row that are the same.
Right.
You know, which the singer would never do.
Right.
And of course, how he does things with balance. All of a sudden, you hear this note. And then suddenly... So the bass becomes suddenly pianissimo. So this can float on top of it, you know, this constant.
You've recorded the work, of course. You've performed it many times. How influential was that performance in 65 on your wanting to play the piece and learning it?
I think there were a number of details that I did completely went over my head before I ever heard this. And I think that are now kind of standard. Mm. We were just talking, you know, things like this, things like, first of all, that he chooses to do the left hand here more than anything. But in other performances, I heard him play it 7 or 8 times. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the things he did was, for example, make sure that this is held over. And then the next time it comes around, this is printed with a double stem. So that became the lead note instead of ta-ra-dee. Instead of that, it became pop, pop, pop.
It goes from being more syncopated to on the beat, and that helps propel him into the next section.
Yes, so that kind of thing. The other place we talked, the rhythmic thing, where he emphasized the fact there's a duple. And then becomes. Which makes such a difference, you know.
And this is all in the score. It's almost as if pianists before him were maybe more casual with their regard to the score, which isn't to say they didn't respect it, but that they kind of knew how the piece goes and they made it their own and they played it.
Either that or he emphasized things that other people didn't. I'm sure that Arau. Also played,
you know,
I'm sure, but you didn't get that difference between and then the idea that it influences the entire phrase. His view was very often, if you can describe it this way, he shone a light on things that were important to him that I think other people didn't hear.
One thing that I find very interesting is that the different teachers that you have represented on Tone Bass, some of them will talk about or teach the same pieces, yet they bring their own slants to the piece. They bring their own interpretations, and sometimes they'll say things that are contradictory, yet they all make sense in some way. And I'm mentioning this because you have Emmanuel Ax talking about the Chopin G minor ballade, but also you have Garrick Olson talking about the G minor ballade. And Garrick Olson and Manny Ax, of course, have been friends since childhood, and they used to go to Carnegie Hall together.
In fact, Garrick teaches the entire G minor ballade for Tone Bass in a 90-minute in-depth lesson, and mind you, this is none other than the 1970 Chopin competition winner. So to hear a pianist of this magnitude, of this caliber, and of this much fame for his interpretations of Chopin, dig deep into one of the most important war horses of the piano repertoire, the G minor ballade, it's just a really special occasion. And I don't know if anybody could have done it quite like Garrick, who I'd say is one of the more erudite, articulate pianists alive today.
So, you know, the old Liszt adage is, the moment you see crescendo, cut back. In other words, well, you don't want to do it so much that it sounds obvious, but you don't need to play this whole coda fortissimo either. When I say that, it should be pretty loud and pretty brilliant, but you don't need to play at the maximum of your physical force, which will just wear you down and also leave you nothing for bars 230 to 238, which have the problem, in addition, of going higher where the sound is thinner. So what you need when the sound is thinner is not weight, but you really need strong attacks. And once again, I keep calling it this relaxation response. There's nothing relaxed about it, but still, I'm actually not holding down. From millisecond to millisecond, I'm actually getting off the notes. Even if you leave your fingers lazily, I can play. But I'm not all stiff with my hand. And it's that stiffness that wears you out. Chopin always talked about suppleness. Also, don't go for speed and power at first. Make sure you know where you are. Make sure you know which notes of the left hand are which ones of the right hand. Because we do have two sides of our brain and each one is dealing with a different hand. After that, you have one of Chopin's greatest theatrical coups. This important material in the left hand. You've got a difficult chromatic scale on the right hand, but you have this important. Which you remember from these build-ups. And very important, do not ignore one. Sometimes people forget about that F sharp or try to get in. The F sharp's more important than all of that stuff in the right hand. The right hand is very important, but you do. Because that gives the piece its final climax. So while the right hand is very important, the left hand is really critical. Then it swoops up. It only takes, months to practice all of that stuff. And I don't mean to be just sort of fast-forwarding through this, but the left hand really has to drive. But we become so preoccupied, which is important, terribly important, but this has to... It's sort of like bringing all the birds coming home to roost. This is really the stake in the heart of the vampire, as you will. Thank you.
we just heard the coda of the G minor ballade of Frédéric Chopin, performed by Garrick Olson. You are listening to Between the Keys here on the Classical Network. I'm your host, Jed Disler, and my guest this week is Ben Lotti, who is the head of piano at Tonebase. Thank you for bringing these wonderful clips of all of these great pianists revealing their kitchen secrets.
Well, you're hearing just a few short clips from what's a library of hundreds of hours now of really priceless video content featuring world-class pianists, including Garrick, but just to name a few others, Jean-Eflamme Bavouzet is on the platform, Simona Dinnerstein, Vadim Holodenko, great professors from different conservatories all around the world, young phenoms. And it really is a kind of emporium.
How do we get to Tonebase?
Pull out your internet and go to tonebase.co. That's just like com, but without the M. And you will see a beautiful website that invites you to sign up for either a guitar or a piano platform. Now, I recommend you try both, but if you just want to stick with piano, you can start a free trial. Now, when you're in that free trial, you'll be able to see the full lessons and interviews of everything you've been hearing today and much, much more. And since it's the holiday season, I should say that it makes a wonderful gift. Give the gift of Tonebase to your pianist friends this holiday season.
I should add that of what I've seen, and I've seen quite a few of these lessons and these performances and interviews, is that the production values are really, really excellent. There's a informality, yet at the same time, they're just so wonderfully put together. And I remember that the two of us did an interview during the Chopin competition a few months ago where we conjured up the fake Chopin competition awards. And you did such fantastic video editing that you really made me look and sound good.
Well, thank you, Jed. And that was for our YouTube channel. So I also recommend, if you want to give Tonebase a try, but you're not quite ready to start a free trial, head to YouTube, visit the Tonebase Piano YouTube channel. And we have many wonderful segments from interviews and lessons there. And also several interviews that I did, as Jed mentioned, about the Chopin competition, including with Alexander Gagiev, who's one of the silver medalists.
In bringing all of these pianists and pedagogues together over the last couple of years, what have you learned that you did not expect?
The first thing I learned, or I should say confirmed, is that pianists disagree with each other constantly. And it's somewhat of a cliche, but there's no right answer. However, there's plenty of wrong answers. Remember, just because there might not be one truth doesn't mean that anything goes. And that's sort of a theme. If you start watching enough Tonebase videos, you'll start hearing great pianists talk about the same topics of pianism, of interpretation, of technique, and you'll hear some competing ideas. Just to give one example, my dear former teacher Jerome Lowenthal, Jerry from Juilliard, he preaches a narrative approach to music making. Everything is storytelling, whether it's Sweelinck or Boulez. Whereas Leon Fleischer, who we were just discussing, preaches, I would say, something more of an architectural approach to music making, something in which you're putting together building blocks to create a sort of coherent whole. Now, that can be reconciled with a more narrative approach, but they really are looking at music from different sides of the same mountain in many ways.
One pianist who was particularly interested in architecture and craft, yet who also talked very seriously and very convincingly about narrative and subtext, was Claudio Arrau. And Claudio Arrau was the same generation as Vladimir Horowitz and in many ways was his polar opposite. And Garrick Olson studied with Claudio Arrau, didn't he?
Yes, this was actually after Olson won the Chopin competition. In the mid-70s, he took several lessons with Claudio Arrau. And you heard Garrick speaking about what he calls a relaxation response. When he's practicing that G minor ballade coda, he points out that you can't continue holding tension on any given note. The moment you play it, you have to release that tension. And in an interview I did with Garrick, he actually attributes that idea to Claudio Arrau, who he said was almost yogic in his approach to music making. And I asked Garrick what it was like studying with Claudio Arrau, and he has a wonderful account of a lesson he had with Arrau on the second movement of Beethoven's first concerto. We've almost exhausted all five of Beethoven's concertos today, but that slow movement is so subtle, and just like Leon Fleischer spent 20 minutes with me on five bars of the beginning of Beethoven 4, Claudio Arrau is much the same. He spent about a half hour, Garrick Olson said, on about seven or eight bars of music. So let's hear Garrick talking about what Arrau imparted to him about this piece.
I was doing the Beethoven First Concerto with him, and you remember that in the slow movement where there's this melody. Later in the sort of middle of the movement, it comes back with an accompaniment in a waltz rhythm. Pizzas in the pinky of the left hand. Well, I played that section for him, and he said, you know, you're a very accomplished pianist. You're very talented. You make it sound very nice. He said, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing. He said, but let's look a little deeper. He said, first, let's look at the Beethoven, the bass line. And Beethoven says, in Italian, under each one, these notes, queste note ben marcate, really marked these notes. And he said, I want to hear this as if played by a great bass section of a great orchestra. I said, I want you to consider the quality of the pizzicato. Is it dry? Does it have some flesh to it? What about the shape of the line? Sorry, I'm doing it fast. There's melody in the bass. You know, and he had me do it in the proper tempo as a melody. We worked on that for about 10 minutes. And then he said, what about the pedaling? Then the next thing he focused on was this. He said, which instruments of the orchestra might be playing? Is it strings? Is it winds? He said, because he said, frankly, you play it like most people play it, a little bit too much like a piano. We have to suggest. Is the third note softer? More? Is there any growth? What's going on in this accompaniment? Because he was establishing what every good conductor knows and every good pianist knows. The melody is obvious. It's how you support it that makes the difference between good and really marvelous. Everybody knows where the melody is, but it's the bedding you put the melody in. So we worked on that, and this became a... And we worked on the touch and everything, and then we actually worked on the shape of the melody and integrating with that. So we spent about half an hour on these, seven, eight bars? After which we were both wrung out, you know. And then he had one last message for me, because I basically thought, I'm not sure I'm ever going to do this. I was still a kid. I mean, I'm partially a kid. It's like, wow. I mean, is he just getting too geeky on all this? You know, who listens to music this way? And he said, you may think that this is too much. He said, first of all, Beethoven wrote it that way. So he said, I really want you to go and practice this and learn how to do it and learn how to become the master of it, he said. Because very often people give up from difficult things because it's not convenient, it doesn't feel good, it's not easy, it doesn't go well. He said, learn to do what doesn't go easily. He says, because in learning all that, you're going to learn a lot of basic principles about playing the piano and music making that even you may not choose to use in that space, he said, but you will have learned tools and principles that will serve you for the rest of your life and everything else you play.
Music from the slow movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 with Claudio Arrau at the piano. And before that, we heard Garrick Olson speaking about studying that piece with Arrau.
Staying with Arrau, I thought we might return to Manny Axe, who never studied with Claudio Arrau, but did listen to plenty of his recordings and also saw him perform. And I mentioned an oral tradition earlier of great pianists featured on Tone Bass, describing what they learned from their mentors, the conductors they worked with, the great musicians that they crossed paths with over the years. There's also something called an aural, A-U-R-A-L tradition that I think is important to piano culture and music making, in which we don't just learn from our teachers and our peers, we learn from the pianist's recordings that we listen to and that you all enjoy so much as part of the reason why you're here listening to Jed's program. Manny not only saw great pianists, but he's one of the great listeners of the piano repertoire and the recorded legacy of the piano. One of the artists that he cites in our interviews is none other than Claudio Arrau, in particular his performance of the Chopin Nocturne in E-flat, Opus 55, number 2, which Manny just learned during COVID and even performed for Tone Bass.
We were talking about the Opus 55, number 2, Nocturne,
yes,
and
yes.
You know, for me, the great recording is Friedman's, but you mentioned Arrau.
Well, it's just a different way,
of,
yeah,
of course,
because the Friedman is so free and mm-hmm. so flowing.
Right.
As I remember, it's kind of sort of like that.
Which is closer to your tempo, I think, this flowing.
Kind of, yeah.
It feels right.
But then this is also quite possible. Also possible. And I think I probably, you know, Rubinstein has three separate recordings of the complete nocturnes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the tempos have changed
A
lot, you know.
With speaking of, I mean, Arrau's, many of his later recordings, you know, after a certain point, they do get slower and weightier.
Yeah,
But you hear everything, right?
Yes,
And here is the beginning of that nocturne of with him. Spacious.
So what you're really hearing, you're hearing the left hand with all the resolutions. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear it. Because they all have... they all... You know, that is in a way the genius of Chopin.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We just heard Emmanuel Ax playing Chopin's Nocturne in E-flat major, Opus 55, number 2. That's a recording made in his home. And this is a recording that is unique to ToneBase. And I would like to thank you, Ben Lotti, for bringing this to our listening audience. Ben, I've gotten to know ToneBase over the past few months, and whenever I go online and explore all of the content, I kind of feel that I'm attending a conservatory without walls, where there are hundreds and hundreds of professors with whom I can have lessons at any time of the day, 24/7. And you don't find anything like this anywhere else.
I'm glad you emphasized that it's without walls, because accessibility is something that we really value. The conservatory is often, I think, rightly seen as a kind of elite, cloistered institution. And there's a very insular culture of classical music that makes your average music lover feel somewhat alienated by what we pianists and musicians do with our professional careers. And so ToneBase, in a way, helps bridge that gap between the amateur music lover, the amateur pianist, or even the professional music maker who is in maybe a geographically more remote location from the great conservatories in Paris and New York and Moscow. ToneBase breaks down these geographical barriers, breaks down these walls, and in a way breaks down that ivory tower or ivory key tower, if you will.
In a way, it kind of harkens back to a 19th century or even late 18th century paradigm, when the piano was the home entertainment center and everybody played the piano at home. You know, you have to remember that Bach did not write the well-tempered clavier for someone to play in Carnegie Hall to 3,000 people. He wrote it for you to play at home on your own time.
Exactly. And it's about education and it's about participation. And those two values are really at the center of what we're doing. And just to give an analogy, I grew up playing lots of sports. There's no barrier between crowd and athlete in the professional sports world. Everyone in the crowd has played those sports. They're yelling very intelligent things at the coach that they think should be done. There's deep knowledge of participating in this culture. In a classical music environment, you often feel this sort of distance between those who have never penetrated the walls of Juilliard or Carnegie Hall. They'll never step foot on the Carnegie Hall stage. It's not for them. No. In fact, music making is for all of us. Some of us happen to do it at a world-class level, but we should feel that we are with them and that they have something to share with us and that we too can make beautiful music at the instrument.
It's about sharing, not preaching.
Exactly, and that's often lost in the classical culture of today. So when we talk about democratizing, that's what I think of.
Thank you very much, Ben. This is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and you have been listening to Between the Keys, which is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. I look forward to being with you next week at this time.